one of the biggest things that's missed by the sort of supply and demand only framework is that leaving a job is not something people do on a casual basis. It takes like a very large wage cut to get even a small number of people to leave.
For decades, the economic model of the labor market has been ruled by supply and demand. But a younger generation of labor economists is pushing back against that traditional model.
I think it makes it seem that the labor market is just like the market for carrots or dishwashers, that there's nothing sort of special about the fact that when we're buying and selling our work, that there's really a whole different set of forces that come into play that don't just look like supply and demand.
Suresh Naidu is a professor of economics and international public affairs at Columbia University. His research focuses on many of the real-life factors that impact the job market in ways that often contradict traditional theories.
It's not that the supply and demand model is wrong, it's that it's just kind of only a part of the story. And if you think it's the only thing going on, it will kind of lead you astray.
Suresh Naidu's article about the increasingly complex world of labor and wages appears in the March edition of Finance and Development magazine. He spoke with journalist Rhoda Metcalf.
In traditional economic models, supply and demand are in complete control of the labor market. But your work raises concerns about how oversimplified that model is. So why is that a problem?
So I think it makes you think that, for example, if automation happens or if trade happens, it's just kind of, well, the labor demand curve shifted and wages fell and employment fell and that's all you can do. But once you have this idea that there's actually a whole set of countervailing forces like wage policies, there's institutions like unions, there's macroeconomic policy, there are things you could have done. And one of the unfortunate things that economists have sort of helped abet is this idea that, well, sorry, like we're going to have trade and some workers are going to lose their jobs and that's just too bad. Maybe we can do some retraining and stuff and get
them. There's nothing you could do about it.
You know, we can compensate the losers, but, you know, that's kind of it. And throws up this sort of helplessness in face of labor market shifts. And I think having this broader view of the labor market sort of expands the space of both what policymakers can do and what, you know, in some sense, workers themselves can do, either via the political process or via organizations. Well, I think the story of just supply and demand makes it look like there's some immutable natural force out there affecting your wages that you can't do anything about.
Right. Interesting. So, I mean, what do you think are some of the most important elements that are missing from the traditional theories?
I don't know if it's the most important, but I think that same way in which you have monopoly power, where a company might not choose to sell as much as it could because it wants to keep prices high. Well, a monopsonist is just that same idea where an employer might not want to hire all the workers it could hire because it wants to keep wages low.
Right.
And once you allow for that kind of monopsony to exist in the labor market, it also means that a whole set of other possibilities for the wage determination get put on the table. That kind of doesn't exist in the supply and demand world because of this, you know, law of one price, law of one wage, where it says that all firms have to be paying the same wage in the same labor market. But once you have this wage setting ability by firms, you get a real role for firms to pay either high or low wages, depending on kind of their labor market strategies. Mm-hmm. So kind of my favorite examples of this is Walmart versus Costco, where they're both big box retailers, but Costco kind of pays very high wages, has low turnover, and Walmart pays low wages. I mean, not as low as it used to, but still lower than Costco, suffers higher turnover. But both of those strategies can kind of coexist, because the lower wages that Walmart pays, it's kind of offset by the higher turnover and higher quits that sort of Walmart has to bear. And the high wages that Costco you know, is paying more, but that's offset by the lower turnover right. that they face. And that's some evidence of the importance of this kind of imperfect competition.
Yeah. I think another element that you bring up is this question of the relationship that employees have with their work. You know, because labor theory basically says that the moment an employee is offered a bit more money from another company, they'll switch jobs. But it doesn't really work that way, right? Because for a lot of people, their job is important to them for reasons that go beyond money.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's an important idea where there's a lot of things about a job that make it work for reasons that are only yours. And so it's got to be close for your childcare, maybe close to your house. And then you have to get along with your coworkers. You have to get along with your manager. You have to kind of get some sort of sense of meaning and identity out of
right.
the job.
Yeah.
And then the important thing about that is that that means that there's some people for whom a given job is going to be like, wow, that really works for me. And there's going to be other people for whom the same job is going to be like, yeah, that doesn't work for me. And then employers don't know which of those is which.
Mm-hmm.
And so what they're going to do is they're going to basically be able to lowball the wage a little bit. And the people for whom it's not a good match will leave. But then all these other people for whom this really works will stay. And so that gives this kind of scope for employers to sort of take some advantage of the fact that people get all of this non-pecuniary and psychological benefits from a given job and kind of exploit that to some degree.
Mm-hmm. And it obviously affects the mobility of workers between jobs, right? There's a cost to leaving one job and going to another.
Yes. And I think that that is one of the biggest things that's missed by the sort of supply and demand only framework, is that leaving a job is not something people do on a casual basis. And I think one of the things that we've sort of seen is an interesting pool of both like experiments and quasi-experimental evidence that kind of really shows that that does not happen. Turns out it takes like a very large wage cut to get even a small number of people to leave.
Right, right. Interesting. We do live in an era of a lot of big corporate mergers, of companies that employ huge numbers of people. How does that affect the relationship between workers and employers?
So I think there's two ways. One is just kind of when mergers happen or when a labor market is already concentrated. Employers aren't shy to take advantage of their size to reduce wages in a given labor market. Big employers do kind of depress wages. And we just actually have some interesting evidence of this from tech, but even from like regular mergers, like think of something like two mines. So mining is an interesting sector because the products are sold on these global commodity markets. So you'd never worry about like the lack of competition mm-hmm. on the product market side. But once you start thinking, okay, in any given place, there's probably like not that many mines, one or two.
Yeah.
And then if those two merge to become one, that's going to be a lot of labor market power held by that one mine,
right.
and that could be used against workers. And so there's I think, just this sense in which like large employers can push down the wage. But I want to qualify this by saying there's something else that happens, particularly in contemporary labor markets, which is that these large bureaucratic multi-market firms can't be so bothered to like set wages individually in every single labor market.
Okay.
And so what we've also seen is sort of the rise of like what one paper calls like national wage setting.
Hmm.
You can see it with Walmart and Amazon kind of passing national $11 an hour minimum wages or $15 minimum wages, where they're tying their own hands and saying, we're not going to pay anyone below this.
Right.
Even in Louisiana, for example, which is a very low-wage state where they could quite easily afford to pay a lot less, they're kind of choosing to not do that.
Getting it to the very bottom is not necessarily a priority for them.
Yeah, and I think it's because there's other considerations that they have in mind. Like, you know, they want to appear to their customers as like fair employers, or they want to appear to politicians as like we're bringing good jobs.
Right.
And so once you have the scope for employers to make these kinds of decisions, you have a whole different set of forces operating in terms of setting wages.
Right. How have the traditional models fit unions into the labor dynamic? I mean, how are unions seen in the traditional version?
Yeah, so in the traditional version, a union comes in and becomes a monopoly supplier of labor, and so it's willing to hold back employment. It's willing to threaten a strike in exchange for a higher wage for its members. Mm-hmm. And so you have this old prediction that unions would increase inequality mm-hmm. because it would raise wages for the insiders, but depress wages for the outsiders. And it turns out, you know, once you get actually any data on wages, you can kind of see that that's exactly does not happen. Basically, like unions kind of reduce inequality among workers.
Right. So, I mean, how do you see the role unions play today? I mean, is it changing? Is it growing? I mean, where do unions fit?
Yeah. So I wrote an article 2 years ago for the Journal of Economics Perspectives called Is There a Future for the U.S. Labor Movement? I ended that article being like, I don't know.
Right. It's complicated.
It's complicated. So I will say that 2023, we did actually see an increase in private sector union coverage. Starbucks just recognized the union. Like, that's huge. I would have never thought mm-hmm. that that would have happened. And then, you know, the UAW is winning majority of workers on cards in like Alabama. Mm-hmm. And so there's definitely something happening, particularly among young workers. Young workers are much more like, let's say, union curious than older workers. And so I think there is a real sense in which like unions have become much cooler and more interesting among the younger cohort of workers than previously. I certainly think COVID had something to do with that and just kind of the shock of that labor market experience in both healthcare, but also in low-wage service sectors. But, you know, I think it was never the case that that many people were opposed to unions, even at their lowest point, the late 1970s, early 1980s. It was still like, you know, more than 50% of people thought unions were like a good thing.
Right.
So even as union density was collapsing, people sort of thought unions should have more influence. And I think what's changed is actually the ability of people and willingness of people, particularly in the US system, to like undertake the effort and difficulty of trying to actually win a union.
Right, right. So, I mean, how does all of this affect the policies we end up with? If in fact we have these labor market models that are not very much in sync or really oversimplify everything that's happening in the real world. I mean, how does that affect the policies that we end up with? Do governments actually use these traditional models in order to develop their policies?
I'm not sure governments use that much of economics, period,
right.
to choose their policies. We have, like, outside of the central banks. But I think within the space of wonkish policy elites, I think the arrival of a competing model of the labor market that actually helps us make sense of a lot of empirical evidence that we hadn't been able to make sense of. For example, that means that like, okay, we can start to get some license to maybe explore how high can minimum wages go. In the US, we still don't have any evidence that we've hit the range at which minimum wages are costing jobs, even though minimum wages have grown by a lot. And some recent evidence has sort of shown that one of the reasons this tight labor market has shown up so much as higher wages is because it's really increased competition at the bottom of the labor market. So workers just in this post-COVID labor market just way more willing to shop around for jobs. Mm. And so employers are complaining about a labor shortage, but it's just a labor shortage to them. It's not a labor shortage to the entire labor market. It's because they are now having to deal with problems of turnover that they didn't have to face because now you have workers that are actually like willing to quit. Mm. And I think that increase in competition is something that's not sort of baked into the traditional macro policy analysis of like what happens in a tight labor market. But I think what we're seeing is that actually an important part of a tight labor market is an improvement in competition at the bottom of the labor market. Mm. And then a third, which is the rise of labor market concerns and antitrust policy, where it's like, it used to be the case that merger analysis would happen and you'd never even think to even worry about the effects on workers. It was just not on the table.
Right.
But now I think with the rise of this like monopsony as a view, we now have mergers being screened for their effects on workers, both in the US and in Europe. You know, we also see like private lawsuits now alleging antitrust violations.
Hmm. Interesting. So, I mean, are there efforts now to update labor market models? Are the textbooks changing? Are the what young students are learning about economics and about labor economics, is that beginning to change?
So no, for most students, but I think it is slowly changing. Like, so I'm involved in this open source textbook project called CORE, and it's very successful. We basically have tried to rebuild the first year economics textbook in a way that really has a much more realistic model of the labor market where firms set wages and they have power in the product market. And we build that up into a model of macroeconomic policy making. And we are trying to have the principle that we will not teach introductory students anything that is wrong.
Right. Good concept.
Well, I think there's a lot of introductory economics textbooks that have the philosophy that the most important thing we do is to teach you the basic framework of thinking about markets, and then we'll kind of add some stuff to make it more realistic. But the most important thing that we teach students is that supply and demand are equal. And we're kind of, I think, have a different philosophy where it's like, we want to help students make sense of the world around them from the get-go. The title of the core textbook is The Economy, not Economics.
Right.
And I think that's a real philosophical difference. It's like, we want to teach you the tools that help you understand the economy, not understand the intellectual edifice that is economics. And so I think it's going to take some time before introductory economics as a whole sort of changes.
Mm-hmm.
But I think eventually it's got to happen, partly because I think students are clamoring for it. They want like an economics that's much more like relevant.
Great. Well, Suresh Naidu, very thought-provoking interview. I thank you so much for coming on the podcast today.
Thank you for having me.
Suresh Naidu is the Jack Wang and Echo Ren Professor of Economics and a Professor of International Public Affairs at Columbia University. He was speaking with journalist Rhoda Metcalf. Look for Naidu's article about the increasingly complex world of labor and wages in the March issue of Finance and Development magazine. And look for more IMF podcasts wherever you get your podcasts. You can also follow us on X, what used to be Twitter, at IMF_podcast. I'm Bruce Edwards.
And I'm Rhoda Metcalf. Thanks for listening.